and welcome to an episode of the Interpreter's Corner. My name is Enrique Andrade, and today I have the honor and privilege of having to interview the Honorable Michelle Rini.
Thank you. It's very nice of you to invite me.
Judge Rini is a juvenile court judge with a lot of experience in both civil and criminal. Judge Rini, good. Thank you for being here on the show. How long have you been a judge?
I started this position in 2006, March to be exact.
And as an attorney before you became a judge, what areas of law did you specialize in?
I primarily worked representing both juveniles and adults in juvenile law. I did criminal law and also family law, in other words, divorce and custody cases.
Ah. What are the main differences for the folks that are wanting to become certified? There's a great deal of information that is, you know, they need to study for juvenile court and for criminal court and for family court. So if you could explain really briefly, what are the main differences between juvenile and criminal law?
Well, if you're speaking about, say, delinquencies in juvenile law, there are a lot of parallels between the criminal system and the juvenile system, as in the idea that someone is charged with an offense, that they resolve that and they can have a trial. And there's a lot of parallels. The youth have the exact same rights as an adult, except not to a jury trial. But when a juvenile is accused of what would be a crime for an adult, it is effectively decriminalized and made, they used to say, an act which, if done by an adult, would constitute a crime. And so they have the same rights, though, to challenge the state's accusations against them. They can also, weirdly, be punished more harshly than an adult can. Adults on felonies, for example, have a sentencing guideline grid that looks at their history and looks at the crime that they've been convicted of, and it plugs in, and that's your sentence. A juvenile can anything be up to the maximum. So a juvenile can actually be incarcerated longer because there isn't a presumptive gridlock sentence. But a juvenile can also be sent to treatment programs because the whole idea is more of rehabilitation and community safety and looking at those issues more than just pure punishment. So it's a different goal in the system for juvenile court.
Thank you. What are some of the main challenges of a juvenile court case, in your opinion?
A lot of the main challenges, you are dealing with kids. Kids are not necessarily rational thinkers, and so they often don't see the consequences of their actions at the time when they need to, as in before they make the decision to do what they do. They don't think it through. And then after the fact, they're often kind of surprised by what the consequences could be. They often don't take things very seriously at first. And that's just, a lot of that is just the fact that they are youth and inherently not the most rational of decision makers. A lot of them have very poor impulse control. A lot of them think that we adults just don't know what we're talking about. And so that can be a little difficult transition for them to suddenly be brought into a situation where the court, who is not a parent, is not negotiating with them and just laying out these are the rules. And it's X, Y, Z, and that's all there is to it. And that can be very difficult for some kids. So getting kids to kind of understand some of those parameters is some of the most difficult. And then working with the parents, who often then interfere with the children making those decisions or in not holding them accountable or not supporting the consequences that the kids have. And if the parents don't support the consequences, the kids often feel that the consequences aren't deserved.
Interesting. In juvenile court, one of the hardest things for me as an interpreter is understanding the many acronyms that exist. Now, there's one in particular that is very complex, and I wanted to see if you could explain a little bit more about it. What is ICWA?
ICWA is the Indian Child Welfare Act. It is a federal law that was put in place basically to go back and try and address slash correct some of the bad things that our previous governments did, as in the removal of Indian children from their families, the when they used to put them in schools and tell them they couldn't speak, and they would strip them of their language and their culture. And now we all know that that's not a good thing. And so this law, when it was put in place, was to put in additional safeguards. So, for example, it gives tribes certain rights over their native children. It increases the burdens of proof. Instead of making reasonable efforts to reunify a family, the state has to make active efforts, which means they have to take those extra steps. It is harder to remove a native child from their family. If it is a non-native family, the child can be removed without expert testimony. But for a native family, you actually have to have expert testimony to say that if you don't remove, they are going to suffer actual harm. And not just it could be, but you have to show that this is very important, this is very serious, you have to do it now. And it's not, it's to weed out cultural bias that maybe they're removing because they don't understand the cultural aspect. But it's very interesting because the Indian Child Welfare Act only applies to federally recognized United States Indians. So if your tribe is not recognized, it doesn't matter, which is kind of harsh.
Are there many tribes that are vying for recognition federally that are still not getting recognition, or what do you think?
There have been tribes that have managed to get their recognition back, and there are tribes that are still not recognized either because they're too small or they don't have the political clout. So there are far more tribes than most people know about because they're not recognized.
Gosh, that is truly a difficult situation for a lot of folks, especially folks that come from Mexico on south from Latin America. You can argue that they're Native Americans, but they don't have the same history or the same political, as you say, clout to have their own tribes recognized in their country of origin. So it's a continuing and evolving issue of equity, I think.
Yes.
So, Judge, what are the differences between delinquency and dependency cases? We touched a little bit about it, but I always find that interpreters find it confusing to distinguish between the two. If you could explain a little bit more about the two types.
Okay, the delinquency system are, again, for youth, and we use the term differently. We say children with dependencies and youth with delinquencies. That's one little difference that you see. So when our youth are accused of doing acts, crimes, basically, breaking the law. Those are delinquencies. They would run parallel to a criminal court case. You're going to have a charging instrument. You're going to have a lawyer. They admit or deny, as opposed to guilty or not guilty. They can have an adjudication. They can be locked up. They can be put on probation. A dependency case is what we call a child welfare case. Or it's another way of putting it is dealing with children who have been subjected to abuse or neglect. That's kind of putting it a little broadly because there's far more to it than that. But it's where the Department of Human Services Child Welfare has stepped in and said there is safety concerns within this family. And those concerns can come from acts by the parent to the child or children, or from the children to other children or other people. And sometimes you get involved just because the child has, say, behavioral and safety needs that the parents are unable to meet, not necessarily through a fault, but because of lack of resources or understanding. So that usually has to do with safety issues.
So Judge Rini, why are there so many attorneys in the courtroom?
Yes, and that's going to be particularly with dependency cases. Due to the constitutional implications with dependency cases, because the state is intervening in a family and asking to have them be granted custody of somebody's child, the parents have a right to have an attorney, and they have a right to have a court-appointed attorney if they qualify. There's only a couple areas of law where that happens, and that's criminal law and juvenile law. And so the parents have a right to have an attorney, and the parents are often what we call party opponents, meaning their interests are not the same. They could be finger pointing at the other, where one is a safe parent, one is not, or one is saying it's the other one's fault. So they get their own attorney. The children have a right to have an attorney, sometimes because of the fact that they have different interests as well. Like, say, one has made accusations against another, they might have their own separate attorneys. The Department of Human Services has their own attorney. The state is represented by the district attorney's office, so there's another attorney. And then sometimes, if we have a court-appointed special advocate, every once in a while, they have an attorney too. So that's far more unusual. So you can have quite a few attorneys on every single dependency case. Basically one per, almost.
And when delinquency just... They're fewer.
Right. You will have the state will be represented by the district attorney's office, and then the child will have an attorney. Now, occasionally, a victim will retain an attorney, but that's usually if they're looking for maybe some greater monetary restitution, or they're looking to ensure that certain rights are being addressed, or maybe they're going to sue the family civilly. But that's pretty rare.
Now, focusing on interpreters right now, what do you look for in an interpreter?
There's a few things that makes for a very good interpreter. When we use interpreters a lot, you start to realize when an interpreter is actually interpreting what is being said as opposed to where you have a question mark. So an interpreter, number one, from the beginning, does not have to be told to start interpreting. Number two, the most important thing is an interpreter who can keep up. Speed is such a wonderful quality to have, but only so long as they can do it accurately. I also appreciate an interpreter who, if necessary, can say, I need you to slow it down or I need you to repeat it, because it's important that we know the person is... being informed of what's going on. So speed and accuracy, being there on time, that seems so small, but it's very important. But also there's those extra touches, those interpreters who sometimes you get the ones where you see where the tone of voice comes through. Now, if I'm in the courtroom, I can hear the person who's speaking in a different language, you can hear the tone of voice. Some interpreters match the inflections, and that's an extra nice touch, but more importantly, accuracy and speed. Those are the two, of course, most important things, I think.
Thank you, Judge. What should an interpreter prepare for if they want to work in juvenile court cases?
I think one of the things that would probably be most important is to learn the terms of art and the abbreviations that we hear every day. It's not appropriate for the court to fall back on those abbreviations all the time, knowing that they don't always make sense if you're speaking to a non-English speaker. And the interpreters are supposed to just interpret what I say. So learning those terms of art are very helpful so that the interpreter knows what we're talking about, as well as just... You know, I get sometimes the blank look, and understandably so, when we're throwing out, you know, ICWA and or RCWA, the Refugee Child Welfare Act, and we're often talking about we're going to have a PTC and then a CJ, and we're doing a TC to DHS. That it would be helpful, I think, for a lot of interpreters if they just knew what that meant. And I think that we as the court and as participants of the court need to do a better job of actually using the words.
Right. Thank you. And a final question, Judge. Is there any other advice you wish to give an aspiring interpreter?
To come to court and watch. Watch, because you can see the difference between a good interpreter and a not as good interpreter. A good interpreter, the courtroom flows. It does not slow down the proceedings. If there's a struggle with the interpreter, that can make the court very difficult. But an interpreter also has to, they have to speak up if something's wrong, because everyone wants it to go well. Everyone wants everyone to understand that if the interpreter needs someone to slow down or speak up, or if the interpreter wants to sit in a particular area of the courtroom, I have no problem when an interpreter says that to me and says, "Your Honor, can I sit over here?" Or, "Your Honor, can, you know, I was unable to hear that. Can I ask for a repetition?" I appreciate that, because then I know that they're on top of it. Now, I don't want to, on the other end, it's not appreciated when an interpreter who's very, very experienced keeps asking everyone to slow down, when I know that for the interpreter standards, they had to learn how to do interpretation at a certain speed.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Judge Rini. I really appreciate your time and sharing your knowledge and wisdom for the new interpreters that are coming up in the very near future. And for the Interpreter's Corner, this is Enrique Andrade.